Would you introduce yourself, please?
Hi, my name's Will Butler.
Amazing. Amazing. And we're here as a solo artist, although you still do represent that other...
I am of Arcade Fire. Will Butler of Arcade Fire, though. Will Butler as Will Butler.
Most people go, oh, Montreal band. So then you got your Truckee, California,
yeah,
and you got your Woodlands, Texas. So can you unravel a little bit about that? Because I think that, you know, the perception is, oh, it's a Canadian band.
No, I was born in Northern California. That's my mom's... Well, my mom was born and grew up in L.A., but went up going to Lake Tahoe every summer. She was a musician. Her mom and her mom's sisters were all singers. And so sometimes they would pull my mom out of high school and be like, oh, Marilyn's sick. You got to sing the third voice tonight. And they would go up to Lake Tahoe and sing for all the mobsters. And she just loves
there are no mobsters in casinos ever.
There were in the 70s. This is the 70s.
Before the 70s.
That was her. That's still her, like... the closest thing to her heart is Northern California. And so I was born there. I kind of think of myself as a Californian, though I lived there for 2 years before we moved to Texas.
Yeah, so Woodlands, Texas.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
It's the archetypal 70s suburb. It's not the 50s suburb. It's not every house is identical. It's the 70s suburb where it's winding streets and streets named after shrubs and cul-de-sacs. And yeah, I mean, I was just a kid. There were playgrounds. There were other kids.
So it was all good.
Yeah, it was all good.
But was your dad Mormon too? Or did he kind of get into the groove?
No, my dad continues to not be Mormon. My mom is Mormon. Her family is like back to pioneer days. But her parents were showbiz Mormons. They were like on TV and playing shows and stuff. And it's a little bit of a different vibe. But yeah, my dad is just Yankee. They've lived on like a handful of islands in New England for like 300 years. You know, they're kind of island people. So it's a very two different vibes. Like he's from... she's an LA Mormon and he's like from Maine. So it's opposite sides of the all sorts of spectrums.
From Woodlands, Texas to Montreal to 2001 and that Arcade Fire band. How did that all kind of, you know, how did you and your brother kind of morph over there?
Yeah. So he was in college and he hated it. And his friend was in college in Montreal and liked it. And so this was, you know, we were in our teens and in our 20s. And so he ended up in Montreal and I ended up in college in Chicago. And I would just kind of bounce back and forth because it was him and a couple of his friends, like not the band that exists now, but it was like, I always knew that I liked playing music with my brother. So it was like, oh, he's in Montreal now. I'll take the border was a little simpler and it was the flights, you know, you could get like a flight for $150 Chicago to Montreal. And I would just kind of ping back and forth when I could. And I was already living in Chicago, so it wasn't going from Texas to Montreal. It was going from Chicago to Montreal. It was in the ballpark of Horrifying Winters, and it made sense at the time.
First solo 2015, another 2016, and then boom. And this thing shows up, and of course, you couldn't, and I don't mean this in any sort of facetious way, you could not have planned a better release date or moment in time. Like if there was a master plan... And you call up Mac at Merge, who's been on the show, by the way. And you go, hey, Mac, you know what? I got the new Will album, and it's called Generations. And guess what? This is going to fit like a glove, not only in what I believe in and what I want to talk about.
The first Butler came to America in the 1630s or something, and Thomas Butler, and he converted to Quakerism. And we think of Quakerism as like this friendly neighborhood religion on the box. They're very peaceful.
It's oatmeal, yeah.
But the original Quakers, just everyone was beating the crap out of them. And all the I can see the historical records of my forefathers because it's just them getting fined for going to Quaker church, like for teaching their kids about Quakerism, like resisting arrest because you're arrested because you're a Quaker and just all that. You know, it's like, oh, okay. And then they just settled down into being Yankees for another 300 years after that.
This thing is such a stew. It really is.
Yeah.
Because it came out of, you know, the mix of who you've become, which is wanting to go back and explore family and all of that, But then it goes so much deeper than that. And I'm going to just harken back to that B-side of the first Arcade Fire single.
Yeah.
Which people probably haven't, I mean, I'm sure it's on YouTube in the appropriate place.
Right, right.
And people can dig it out. But your grandfather on the radio, I mean, that was many, many, many years ago. And yet, as you were starting to make this, did you think about that?
Yeah, a lot. I mean, stew is the word. Because my grandfather was born Alvin McBurney, was a guitar player, changed his name to Alvino Ray for showbiz, and was there at the birth of the electric guitar. He was probably the first electric guitar player that all Americans heard. And he was playing a Hawaiian, like a lap steel. He was playing a Hawaiian guitar with the name Alvino Ray, and he was playing jazz music. And so it is very thorny. not in a negative way. I'm not in a judgmental way. Just like it's so complex. There's a lot of different elements moving along there. And yet elements of it are super pure, where it's a kid who learned how to play guitar and he was the only guitar player in town and just played music his whole life. So there's that. There's both elements are there.
So when you sat down and said, okay, I'm not using your accent, by the way. I'm doing mine. But,
yeah.
You know, okay, I'm going to make the next record. It's going to be about this. But there's a lot of about thises. So how did you sit down and say, well, this is the overarching idea, but there are all these other places I need to go, and they're going to be personal stories. So how did you sit down and go, okay, this is going to be the narrative for this thing?
Yeah, it operated on two levels. One, it was musically, it was just following where the music went, and it was following, there's a lot of bass in this record, and it was kind of just like, where's the bass taking us next? But then lyrically, I don't know, there's been four or five times in the last 4 or 5 years where I've felt about as dark as I've felt in my life, and you completely lost, like personally and within the world, and the world feels like chaos and you feel like chaos. And those came at different moments, and they didn't all come after Trump got elected. But yeah, there was a common theme there, and I feel like I'm bouncing through those themes a little bit of just like the moments of feeling lost and then what comes after.
So this record, despite what we're about to get into, is joyously created. It really is.
Yeah.
But I always call this music, and I say this almost every time now, it's a Tootsie Roll pop. The happier people and those of us that know how to create joy also understand darkness. So the Tootsie Roll pop is that shiny, crunchy, fruity outside that you bite through to get to the really dark, gooey center.
Yeah.
And this has been an Arcade Fire and a Your Trick since day one. So own up to it, will you please? But
yeah,
it's true.
Extremely much. It's a rock and roll Tootsie Pop. That's completely it. And the music can't help but be creative and joyful because it's intrinsically, it exists and it goes into your body and it makes you feel something. Like no matter, any dark song that I listen to still makes you feel alive. You listen to Leonard Cohen and you feel alive. You don't know why
you feel alive when you're listening to, you know, I feel like I'm going to die, but I feel great.
Yeah. It's embodied. It's like in your body in a way that rejects any nihilism that's present in the song.
Let's start with Out of Here and let's start with the Korg MS-20.
Yeah.
And let's start with that making you happy in the sounds of that. That's not a happy instrument. That's a pretty meaty.
Yes,
thing.
It's a real gnarly thing. It feels like it's made out of electricity. It's like you're short circuiting two wires together, and a sound is coming out. And sometimes it sounds beautiful, and sometimes it sounds like you're short circuiting two wires directly into a tape machine. And it's a synthesizer that's very transparent. Like you can get, it feels electric, and you can. When you learn how to use it, it's a little complicated. It's like doing it's doing like an eighth grade science fair. It's not super complicated, but it takes a little bit of crossing wires. But you can get a really gnarly bass. And that's always what I return to, is just you can get a gnarly bass that just goes straight into your rib cage. And to feel that, like when you do it, it just feels really good. You're like, oh, this, I touched something and then something touched me back. And I wanted to start the record with that because it's, I don't know, it's just an instrument that I've played for a decade now. And I'm pretty, I'm like basically a dilettante. Like I play a little piano and I play a little guitar, but the MS-20 I've like played for a decade and I've read the manual and I've listened to records with it on it. And it's the thing that I most, can be most expressive on in a certain way. And yeah, it's just, that's like, I feel expressive. Let's make a record.
But in this case, it's like, whoa, it's a ride. And you know, I mean, if you did have commercial tendencies, starting a record without a here,
yeah,
would be probably be a death, you know, a death warrant right there, wouldn't you say?
Well, that's why I like being on Mac's label, because Mac's like, cool, I like this.
What's interesting about rock and roll is these days, and especially like the younger kids, they're like, oh, I dropped out of college to form a band. And what they don't realize is that many years later, they're going to go, I think I'm going to go back.
Yeah.
You know, there's some stuff I want to learn. But the irony for me of, I don't know what I don't know, and what you know.
Yeah.
Is kind of interesting.
Yeah, though, the one of the things I took from going back to school was learning precisely the limits of our knowledge. We were like, oh, this is how schools work. And then you look into it and you're like, oh, we don't actually know how schools work. We don't know what happens. Like, we don't know what happens to the kids, how they come out. And like, in order to know, you have to follow a kid for 60 years and you just don't, you learn the limits. There's many things we do know, and there's some freaking no-brainers we could do to make life in America a lot better. But there are limits to our knowledge, even as like, there have been people of goodwill trying to do good things for a long time. And we've learned a lot about what doesn't work.
Tell me about the class taught by Leah.
Yeah, so I took a class with this professor, Leah Wright-Rigger. She's a historian. And the class was essentially, I forget what the title was. It was like something like Race and Riot in America, which...
A happy class.
A happy class and pretty apropos. But one of the through lines was reading about the different riots and uprisings in American history, particularly tied to race, and reading the causes and the outcomes, and reading... There are all these postmortems that happened. But we went back... There was a riot in Chicago in 1919, and well-meaning people wrote a report in 1920 about how did this happen? Like, why are whites and blacks fighting in the streets of Chicago? And they look at it and they say, oh, well, we've noticed that in the media, when a black person commits a crime, we always identify the race. And when a white person commits a crime, we tend to gloss over the race. And like, this seems to be adding to the to the problem. And we noticed that Once the fighting got underway, the police always sided on the side of the white people, even if they started it and they were arresting the black civilians. And perhaps we should reform how the police approach these situations. And it's not exactly like 100 years ago, but you read in this report, and this was in 2016 when I was reading this, and your jaw drop and you just drops to the pit of your stomach, and then you read the reports after the 60s, like the Kerner Commission report and after the Watts Riot report and then the DOJ report after Baltimore, the DOJ report after Ferguson. And it's a very clear and bright through line through the last 100 years. And it's, you know, it's heavy and things have gotten better, but it's there, like it's present, the injustice.
It's incredible, isn't it? It's just you just look at what's going on and you just say, okay, what's new? Everything. What's old? Everything.
And so, but studying with Professor Rigger was amazing because she's a historian in a policy school. It's like an applied science, it's a technical school. So it's, I'm a historian, but I'm teaching you history with an eye towards what are you going to do and what the heck is going on. And literally the last day on the syllabus, because I was there for the election year, the last week on the syllabus was Donald Trump. the second to last week was Hillary Clinton. The last week was Donald Trump. And it was like, oh, I feel not prepared for this next couple of years, but thank you, Professor. Like, this is...
Yeah, you were walking in with your eyes wide open, at least.
Yeah.
But what did you go back to that gave you solace and hope?
I mean, I'm a reader. I just go to books. I like pick up Emily Dickinson and like read about death in the 19th century, or I kind of go back to that. When I go back to high school, I kind of go back to like Dostoevsky and stuff, like, you know, the stuff I read that kind of, that just totally fritzed my mind when I was 16. It's like, oh, right.
And yet it prepared us. It really prepared us, didn't it?
Yeah. It's like, this is why I talk this way. This is why I think this way. It's like, all right, because I read this when I was 16. Like, good to remember.
You wrote some of these a while back, but yet, you know, it's not like you're some sort of, you know, psychic or anything. But do you have a lot of people saying to you, are you sure you didn't write this like in the past week and a half?
I mean, this year has been too crazy, but it is an outgrowth of the last, it's not a bolt from the blue. Like, this makes sense with the history we've been in. Like, this makes sense with the last few years. This makes sense with the last couple decades. There's been some really dark through lines that have kept growing. Like, a lot of the hate that's out there and a lot of that shite, it's been on the scene for a while now. Since the president got sick, I've actually felt a little hopeful. Like, I've allowed myself to hope. It's like, oh, okay. Like, maybe something will, like, maybe there's a glimmer of, like, a better world. But not too much. It's like a very narrow hope, but there's
yeah, hope. Yeah. And unfortunately, though, it's kind of evil hope in some ways, because you know that it's kind of like you have a mosquito and you're going like this and you're trying to make sure you get it before it bites you.
Yeah.
And then you go, boy, that sucker's fast. And you just wonder, is it possible that I'm actually going to crush the fly?
Yeah.
You know, is it doable? Fine. You end with a waltz.
Yeah. I go back and forth. Sometimes I feel a little sick and sometimes I feel a little okay. At the end of the record, you're like, oh, which is good. I think you could, sometimes I leave that song exhausted and sometimes I leave it refreshed. But I have a different perspective because I'm the guy singing it. So my mood is not going to be the same as the listeners, though. You never know.
I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. And what it is two of your songs on the outside. And then you get to pick a pile of songs in between.